I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and it's Friday, so let's see what Duff McKagan's got going on with the illustrious, always anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling here. Hope you're doing well. Hope everybody else out there is doing well. You know, when we make pizza at home, it's my wife's job to shred the cheese. Yeah, she's the greatest. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That was good. Well, Susan McKagan is pretty great. And I love that joke. And I love you too, Duff. Thanks for sending it in every Friday. And Duff's new solo EP, This Is The Song, is out now. Three new songs, all for Mental Health Awareness Month, which is now the month of May. And of course, you can see Duff and Guns N' Roses this summer in Abu Dhabi, all across the States as well. And Fozzy's on the road as well, as we are in the middle of our Ugly Kid Joe and Pistols at Dawn tour. We had a great show in St. Charles, Illinois last night, just outside of Chicago. And tonight we're in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We hit Turtle Lake tomorrow night at St. Croix Casino. That's the 20th. 21st will be in Indianapolis, Indiana. 22nd on Monday will be in the Rust Belt, Moline, Indiana as well. And then we got to go over AEW Double or Nothing in Las Vegas over Memorial Day weekend. It's a busy, busy time for me. As always, it's been a crazy couple months. Back on the road to finish up the Ugly Kid Joe Fozzy co-headlining tour June 1st in Atlanta. Then we head to Cottonwood, Alabama, Fort Myers, Florida, Tampa, and then we close it out June 5th in Destin, Florida. The full list of tour dates and all ticket information is at FozzyRock.com. We are doing our legendary VIP meet and greet, one of the best in the biz. We take pictures with you, we sign things, we chat with you, do a Q&A, and we play a private mini concert for you. Five songs every night. We've got a few spots available. Go to FozzyRock.com. You can also get the level of VIP where you can play guitar, play bass, or sing with Fozzy. So go check that out at FozzyRock.com. We'll see you on the road. And speaking of being on the road and speaking of AEW, Raphael Morphy returns to Talk is Jericho. He's AEW's Vice President of Touring and Events. He was also on the Chris Canyon Memorial Podcast. They're really good friends. But Raphael's been in the business for over 30 years. He worked for Vince McMahon at WWE and helped out TNA for years before coming to AEW. He talks about his start in the wrestling business, how a Stone Cold Steve Austin first pitch at a Yankee game ended up with Raph working for WWE. He's got stories about Vince McMahon and booking Madison Square Garden, and he shares his AEW journey, including his first meeting with Tony Khan, explains what it was like to get venues to take a chance on AEW live shows in the early days of the company, great stories about the Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York City, where that idea originally came from, talks about how AEW was affected during the pandemic and why that ended up being a great thing for AEW in the long run. He talks about what it's like to promote a show in any given market, the logistics of traveling, production from city to city, some of the factors that go into determining whether AEW would bring the show, Dynamite, Rampage, or maybe Collision upcoming to a certain city. It's a fascinating look at the live business of professional wrestling with Raphael Morphy right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so I am here with Raphael Morphy, who I've known for, gosh, I don't know, 10?
About 25 years.
25 years? Yeah. Has it been that long?
I was thinking about that yesterday, yeah.
Now, here I'm going to ask you this with complete and utter transparency. Now, obviously, you're the guy that I always go to for ticket numbers and for ticket information. What exactly is your title?
My title is Vice President of Live Events and Touring with All Elite Wrestling.
Okay, so Vice President of Live Events and Touring. So obviously we met because you used to work for WWE.
Correct.
Now that must have been quite the honor because you grew up in New York. I know you were a good friend of Chris Kanyon's.
Yep.
You were on when we did the Chris Kanyon kind of tribute show. But first of all, explain exactly what your job is.
Sure. Job responsibilities are here with AEW to book the venues, to be the main liaison between the venue, talent, in terms of any issue, back of house, whatever it may be. But in terms of booking the venue, the local promotion of the show, things of that nature, anything and everything involving the talent, our show, and the ticket sales.
Now, is this what kind of like what Bret Hart did? The other Bret Hart.
Yes.
So WWE had great guy.
Yep.
Yeah, both Bretts are great. Yep. But the other Bret Hart, he was kind of maybe higher up when I first got to WWE. He seemed like he might have been the head of the department.
Yeah, I worked with Bret. I worked for Bret when he was at WWE. He's Tampa-based. But yeah, it's same type of responsibilities.
So let's go back to you grew up in New York.
Correct.
And what got you into this position, and how did you get started working for WWE? Because obviously probably that's a dream for you.
It was a dream, and I'll say this. I was at WrestleMania 1 in 1985.
Oh, wow.
As a fan, and the first trip my mom let me go with my teenage buddies on the road was WrestleMania 3. So I was
Pontiac Silverdome.
Yeah, I was there. I was there as I was 15 years old, I believe.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
So it was phenomenal. So I was always a fan, and as you mentioned, I grew up in the same block, same neighborhood with Chris Kanyon. We were always involved in loving wrestling. But in terms of my career, out of college, I worked in many sports TV stations locally in Boston College, and from there, it evolved to working for the Kraft family, who owned the Patriots. So I worked with them, and an opportunity came working at the FIFA World Cup, where I oversaw stadium and press operations at Giant Stadium. In 94, segued into a job with the Mets, New York Mets baseball team. And it was there where I met Michael Cole and Steve Austin when he threw out the first pitch at a Met Yankee game. And things went well with Steve, and Steve put in a good word for me over there.
What do you mean? Well, were you kind of his rep for the day?
His rep for the day with the Mets. So I was working for the Mets, and Steve came, and I arranged it with Michael and other people from WWE at the time. And Steve came, and he just enjoyed his day, and he put in a good word for me. And
what did you say to him? Like, if you ever have anything in WWE that you need, ticket guy? Or
no, I mean, with Steve, I just, I gave him a space. I mean, he was I would say a top 10 celebrity at that time in 1999 in terms of all pop culture.
Peak of his celebrity. Yeah.
It was July of 1999. He threw out the first pitch. In terms of, engaging and interacting with him, he liked the experience of how I handle things, I guess, for lack of a better term. And Michael liked it. And working with the TV crew in terms of shooting the package, I think we did a drop-in package the next day for Sunday Night Heat. So it evolved into that. So I have to thank Michael Cole and Stone Cold Steve Austin for opening up the doors for me at WWE. Soon thereafter, I got a call and had a couple of interviews. And I met with Ed Cohen, a name you probably remember.
Yeah.
A legend in the live event business. I was working in marketing promotions with the Mets at the time and also with Clubhouse Matters. So it all evolved, and being a fan, I was very intrigued. I loved the opportunity of possibly going on the road for shows. I love baseball. I played baseball. Played baseball in college. But being in the same venue each and every day for homestands could be a grind, and I was young. I was in my late 20s, and I jumped at the opportunity to work at WWE.
So when you start, because you mentioned, I mean, we talked about Bret Hart, but I guess Ed Cohen would be the better example. So Ed Cohen he's no longer with us. Great guy.
Yeah. And, God bless him.
He was basically, like you said, the top dog in booking WWE shows.
Correct.
I'm kind of speaking a little bit paraphrasing, but he probably went back to the 80s when they were booking two shows a night or three shows a night. Like, he had been through all aspects of the WWE, WWF system.
He was there in all aspects when they had those multi shows in one day. He, it was him, and I think him and Howard were one of the first, Howard Finkel, one of the very few, first employees they ever had there.
Vince ever had,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, from
I learned a lot from Ed, and he was a tough boss, but he was a fair boss. Mm. And, you know, I can say that for a lot of folks I worked for at WWE. He was tough but fair. Yeah.
And so when you go there, how do you start making your way up the ladder, so to speak? What are your jobs when you first arrive?
Well, one responsibility I was granted, and I was very lucky, having strong contacts in the local New York market, they gave me the opportunity to oversee and promote and be the venue liaison for all shows at Madison Square Garden, all shows in the tri-state area. So wow. that was a big, big role there. And from there, in terms of proving yourself and putting some time in, you were given other markets to promote locally.
Well, let's talk about the Garden, obviously the world's most famous arena.
Correct.
You know, I'm sure they probably have gigs there 4 times a week, maybe more, who the hell knows. How do you promote a WWE show? If we say WWF, you guys know what we're talking about. It was the WWF at the time, but WWE. How do you promote a WWE show in the market of New York City and Madison Square Garden, which is probably the entertainment capital of America, maybe Las Vegas, but it seems like New York might even be more so.
Yeah, more so. I mean, and back then, they were playing the venue more frequently,
too. Yeah, every 6 weeks, it seemed, or is that what it was?
Every 6 weeks. So the challenge was there, I mean, not only having your relationships with the local media partners, whether it be radio, TV at the time, but also soliciting those third-party opportunities where you can tap into an advertiser's media plan via an appearance when we're leading up to the show, on show date, where they build a promotional plan where the payoff is that talent being at said location to sign. So, you know, that, we always call that other people's money when we promote it. It's something Bret Hart and I had mentioned, and we used to tell folks in our department, great, you have a budget to spend. You can allocate that, and we have tremendous resources here in terms of PR, et cetera, but how can we utilize other folks' money, other people's money in terms of media partners, promotional partners? Mm-hmm. And that came in either through straight solicitation of local businesses around, or a lot of the media partners and radio stations introduce that for you. And then you can craft a package where you offer WWE or AEW resources, and they could sell it as a radio station to the client, and you inherit all that media, which those items are important when you're in the market frequently. And it wasn't only MSG. We were playing at that time the Meadowlands Arena, Nassau Coliseum. Sure. So
yeah, Nassau, and then you also got, like, you know, Boston's just up the road, that Fleet Center and all those big places,
all
too.
That. Philly. So, yeah, whether it's car dealerships, appliance stores, things of that nature. Back then, we're talking about.
No, I remember because Hugo Savanovich.
Yes,
was he a promotions guy as well?
Hugo Maslick, I believe his name was.
Sorry, wrong name. Hugo Maslick.
Yeah, and I replaced him. He left to go to the Daily News.
Okay, but I remember working with Hugo Maslick, and it was very important to go do the signing at the local car
dealership.
Car dealership, yeah. Mm-hmm. And not understanding, like, not that I had an issue with it, but why is it so important to go to the car dealership? And he mentioned for that because the local presence they had could really direct people to the Garden.
Correct. Because, you know, they had their media budgets. They have, and they're spending on so many stations because they're a car dealership and they have the capital to do so, and they have the leverage because they're, you know, with these advertisers, they're, you know, they're incumbents that are placing each and every week, so they get better rates. So that's why those type of businesses were attractive to partner up with at that time.
It was like a Madison Square Garden budget for advertising, mm-hmm. even though we're selling 15,000 tickets or trying to. It's not a lot of money. I remember hearing when Hugo explained, it was like it's $1,500. It was like some really small amount of money.
It averaged anywhere between, I would say, 20 to 25 grand back then.
That's still not a lot for New York City.
Not at all. Not at all. So you had to seek other opportunities to promote and be out there. And then you have your more traditional methods, earned media, doing publicity tours. I remember being with you on many during our WWE tenure. So there's ways about it. But in terms of promoting and getting your tickets sold, they're very effective means. And they're very effective means to do so after you have to have a well-built marketing plan going into an on-sale and on the go-home, whether it's 7 to 10 days or 2 weeks. But that middle portion, so it sustains itself in terms of the pace of sales, that's key. That's when you have to bring in a lot of partners, whether it's radio stations bringing them to you, on-air promotions or radio stations, but also those opportunities with other business partners in the local market.
And this is also too pre-social media.
Correct.
So
correct.
Now you can, you know, I mean, for anything you can promote almost the whole thing on social media. Yeah, if you know how.
You could, but those methods still work too. Those old school methods, because they have media budgets, they have ad budgets in with local stations, you know, whether they're local affiliates, whether they're the local sports network, RSNs, which are more prevalent now than they were then, like the Yes Networks of the world or Bally's, things of that nature. So a lot of those businesses advertise on those platforms because a lot of people are watching sports.
You mentioned kind of the on-sell, and we'll get to this. I know that there's a few other guys that you've worked with, but I'm a guy that's probably constantly hounding you. I'm a numbers guy. I do it with Fozzie. I do it with the Jericho Cruise. Like,
love
I like
it,
knowing.
I love it.
Exactly, because it drives me crazy when you're like, well, the promoter hasn't given us an update yet. And it's like, if I was a promoter, which I am now with the Jericho Cruise, I would want to know every single minute how many tickets there are and how many tickets are out there. How important is the on-sale? Are the majority of tickets bought in the first couple days?
I would say it is essential. It is the end all and be all. So right now, I mean, back then, we're talking 15, 20 years ago, it was the actual general public on sale where you have talent at a box office and what have you.
I remember that at Baltimore Arena, wait to sit there at the table on the on sale day. Yeah,
yeah, but now there's so many pre-sales. Because data is king right now,
data is king.
Yeah, data is king. You know, having databases, having email bases, harvesting that data from previous ticket sales through other partners that you have, and you can sell a lot of tickets via the pre-sale mechanism. And then then you have your general public on sale. So I would say now you would have 70-80% of your sales on the pre-sale sold. Yeah, it depends. But a strong, acute interest in a show, you're going to see that 70-80%. For instance, we just had a pay-per-view go on sale for Forbidden Door in Toronto. Most of it went on the pre-sale in that regard. But I would say on average, average show, you probably have 60% of your sales off the gate, and then another 20-30 on the go-home period. Different markets vary. Border towns, hand over cash type of markets where folks may not have incremental cash. You may see a bigger go home period, but I would say on an average, 60 at the start, 20-30% on the last week or last 10 days. And in the middle, you have trickling here and there. So that's why you have to have other mechanisms, other ways to skin the cat. You have to have that, because if you go in thinking I'll rely on this and that, on the hard cash and some publicity there, you're not doing your company justice in that regard.
Well, it's funny because even playing with Fozzie for 23 years now almost, but I remember the early days to be like, well, walk-ups, you'll get, I can't remember what the thing was, 40% of your tickets are walk-ups. And now it's like this hard, sometimes there's no walk-ups, zero, because it makes it so easy now to buy tickets.
Correct.
That, no one's waiting to the last minute. They can just buy it on their phone, I'll go next week or whatever it may be. That's kind of gone out the window. We still get some walk-ups.
Some walk-up here and there. I mean, we had a great one at the Forum back in January.
We did, right.
And that's
Winnipeg was pretty good.
Winnipeg was very strong. Thanks. He did a lot of media out there, and Kenny did too, and others. But a lot of it, because it's accessible right now to purchase. It's easy to buy a ticket on a mobile platform. But if the product's hot, if there's interest, it matches stimulating buys, then you'll have folks coming out on that walk-up.
Can you see that even to this day? Like if they announce a hot match, that you'll see okay, there's an uptick.
Yeah, no doubt. One I remember last year, we moved a lot of tickets, was at UBS Arena, Darby versus Jeff Hardy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we really jumped that last week. I think it was May of last year, May 2021. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it still happens.
Talk a little bit more about working with WWE. So did you ever have meetings with Vince?
Yes.
How were those meetings and what consisted in those?
Our meetings with Vince, I had a couple of McMahons as my direct boss. Vince was, on one occasion, more so Stephanie. My office is right next to Stephanie's for a long time. But in terms of Vince, he was fair. A lot of it was going over our bookings for where we're going in terms of routing, et cetera. And if he didn't like something, or he had some input in terms of how things can improve from a TV venue standpoint, or a venue to lay off for a time, he'd be open and he contribute that. And he was fair in that regard, and he listened to what our rationale was, especially when brand extension happened and we had two simultaneous tours. Mm-hmm. And he would give his feedback from TV, from talent, and it was good structure in that regard. Now in working with him, I would say he was fair. And he was a fair boss in that regard. He was always open when I was in the gym late at night and I had a crazy idea, what have you. And he listened to me. He didn't blow me off in that regard. I remember telling him about Arthur Ashe Stadium in the gym. This is when it did not have a roof.
Okay.
And his response was, "Well, isn't it open air? But yeah, it's a good location. It's centralized. It's where a lot of our fan base is." And I explained to him that a roof is coming there, and eventually did. And I was no longer in WWE, and we had the opportunity to do it here. Thanks.
That'll become our home arena in New York City.
Oh, it's great. I mean, we came out at the right time here at AEW, where there was there's options in a New York market to place. Not only MSG and MSG, we've had conversations with them, but they have loyalty to WWE, and I don't blame them. I was a small part of that on the other side, so I appreciate their loyalty and how they feel committed to WWE. But as you said, we embraced a venue that's our own, and it was a venue, being an Arthur Ashe Stadium. It's something that we embraced, took over, and something we were going to do right in our infancy.
Really,
we were going to have that pay per view on your birthday.
Mm-hmm. It was going to be in.
We thought about it
about Arthur Ashe.
Arthur Ashe. Oh,
okay,
Arthur Ashe, similar to Safeco, where you had that match with Sean at WrestleMania 19. It's open aired. Even though it has a roof.
Right.
And we were concerned about the conditions. Big show in New York, right in the first month of our
existence.
Let's play it safe.
Yeah.
And that's what we were right, because if you remember in Baltimore, where we did have the pay-per-view full gear, it was 20 degrees that night. In the Northeast.
I remember,
I remember because it was your birthday.
That's true.
So we had it, we had a conversation with Arthur Ashe Stadium, and we... Great dialogue, great people. Danny Zausner there, Chris Dudley, great folks. We nurtured that, and we were going to have a show soon after the pandemic date. Mm-hmm. It was going to be sometime in 2020. Obviously, we didn't have it. I'm amazed that we were able to keep it under wraps and surprise everyone.
We've done two great gates there as well.
We did over 20,000 folks the first time out, and then we did a $1 million gate
where
Jericho became Ocho. If I remember.
That's the truth, yeah. So you mentioned talking about Vince Lombardi, you mentioned you had some crazy ideas that you ran past Vince. What, do you remember any of them that you went to him with?
Remember the skaters from Canada?
The skaters?
Yeah, I think it was 2002 uh-huh. Olympics about the gold medal.
Oh, yeah.
Controversy.
Right.
I remember going up to him. Kurt was... it was around leading up to WrestleMania, and Kurt's a real gold medalist. I'm like, let's bring him out and let's have fun with that.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea, but I don't want to disrespect those kids in that regard. So that's one idea. But he used it because the Kurt used it in his promo at WrestleMania that year. I think it was the one in Toronto, but I try not to bug him too much, but he's always receptive.
Any outside of the box promotional ideas, like, hey, we should do a show here or something? I mean, you mentioned Arthur Ashe, but I mean, I remember we had a pay-per-view in Puerto Rico and that sort of thing. Like, this seems to be a little bit off the beaten path.
Yeah, I mean, that was one that we really had to sell hard. I was there. I was my show. And it's something that Ed really wanted to do, novel. And it was costly at that time getting a TV production done in Puerto Rico. I know they're going to have two shows here coming up. But we had to get a container with a ring there. So that was one idea. In terms of crazy ideas, a lot of the tribute to troop things that we did were off the beaten path. I know we had a show at the Fayetteville Crown Coliseum where we invited all Fort Bragg to come out, but we didn't know if they were going to come out or not. So. I remember Kevin Dunn specifically asking me, are you sure we're going to have folks come here? Because we comped it out.
Oh, yeah.
They came, but it was, you don't know until the folks are there. And we're shooting TV, and it's Yeah, so you know, those are some things that I remember.
You know, it's so interesting. It's
being unconventional.
Comps are hard too because there's no skin in the game.
Correct.
So it's like we gave out 100 comps. It's like, well, it doesn't mean 100 people are showing up.
Correct. I mean, usually comp ratio, I would say anywhere between 40% to 50%.
Do show up or don't.
That do show up.
Gotcha.
More often than not, they do not. But you know, but there's some groups out there that you know that utilize comps effectively. Mm. There's a group out there called VetTix. And you see a good utilization rate. They're veterans, and they come out. They love wrestling.
Last couple of things about Vince. Did he have any rules? I know because sometimes my point is that we'd go to Lafayette, Louisiana, and he would not say Lafayette. He would just say, "Here we are in Louisiana." Yeah. You weren't allowed to say the name of the city because he felt it was too small.
I mean, we would hear that. I not from Vince. It was more Kevin would convey that to us. We're going to come here, and it's going to be. It was usually a university town. Mm-hmm. We're going to call it Penn State University,
right?
We're here live from the University of Texas. When we're in Austin, so I get it. I mean, folks know those. That name or that entity more than the town we're in. Mm-hmm. It was one time I remember we did a TV in Jonesboro, which didn't work well for TV, and I heard it. I think it was the angle where Stephanie revealed where she was a villain. Not the one where
they got married or something.
Yeah, they got married. It was the one shot where that screaming shot where Stephanie's screaming and her saliva's there and great with her intense eyes. It was there in Jonesboro, but I remember she. He came back and she came back saying that venue was really tough to work in. So, you hear that a lot. Great town, it's a house show.
Is there certain specifications that you have to adhere to when you book buildings?
Yes, certainly. I mean, and Tony Khan does a great job communicating that to me often. Ideally, we want to be in a town that, especially us that at AEW, we have less TVs than another company. A town that has professional sports is always big. Also, a town that is within the top 25 usually in DMA. I mean, there's reasons why you may go outside of the top 25 market, a calculated risk in that regard. So, a good facility. We at AEW, we have to look at other facilities for reasons where we're not able to get dates.
Well, the thing is, too, we've always been smart too, and rather than playing the hockey arena in town, we play the university arena and fill it up. I mean, it seems like a smarter way to do things.
Yeah, especially when we first started, it was an effective tool. For instance, where we are today, I mean, we're in St. Louis, and here we're at the Chaffetz Arena. It's not the main arena, but it's the right size arena for us in terms of. Where we're at as a company now.
Who plays here in this arena?
St. Louis University. Who program?
Is it a hockey arena or basketball?
Gotcha.
So obviously, we're not going to go where the Blues play. I can't remember the name of that place is, but we're at the place where the college basketball team plays.
And we would for a pay per view.
Yeah.
Good venue deal. Sure. And we played big rooms also.
Yeah.
I'll say this about the pandemic. The pandemic really, really. Helped us out on many levels.
Helped us out, really?
I think so. I'm going to give you a couple of reasons. Number one, I mean, and you can attest to this because you were here from the beginning. Chemistry-wise, I think it helped us out backstage together as a family. And I don't use that term loosely. Mm-hmm. It did. I would say from a TV viewing standpoint, it evened the playing field in terms of the product.
Interesting, yeah.
Where, the production bells and whistles weren't there in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I know the Thunderdome came and we changed things too. But I'll say this, coming out of the pandemic, venues were starving for programming.
Oh, yeah.
Starving for programming. So that's why I bring it up. Venues, and there were some that were apprehensive to book us, just were elated to hear from us because they just wanted to get programming in. Where maybe if there wasn't a pandemic, it would have taken a little bit more time to cultivate that relationship.
Right.
So that helped us. It did. And, and I think, and I can't speak for venues, but I think some venues, communicated to the WWEs of the world or concerts. We have to bring them in. We have to make, we have to have so many dates in terms of programming in our house because we miss so many.
Sure.
So those three reasons, I think it helped us as a company. obviously, you know, I thank, you know, Tony Khan for, you know, for keeping me around, quite frankly, when we were doing houses in terms of during that time of the pandemic. But I'll say this, I'm very proud that this company, AEW, we were the first company to have socially distanced fans for a show. And that was, you know, that was a big project because we, you know, fortunately, we were in the state of Florida where they were soliciting sports leagues right. to have all their leagues there. And they did. You know, they wanted to make sure WWE was there. They were UFC, ourselves. So, you know, we were all essential employees under that deemed entertainment. So that was a big thing. And then we you know, we worked a lot with the municipal folks and in Jacksonville.
We had a lot of military there for military, a while, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, but making sure we're socially distanced and safe. We never had an outbreak at our show. So I'm very proud of that. And then coming off that, we were the first show in wrestling, pro wrestling, to have a full capacity crowd
at the Daily's place.
Yeah, it was a great night. I remember it was a night you guys ended up in the ring with the Inner Circle,
Stand Up Stampede too. Yeah,
that was one of my favorite nights ever in this business.
Yeah,
because you knew we were coming back, mm-hmm. and the fact that we were the first company to have a full capacity crowd, which we did. I mean, albeit it was, you know, just shy of 6,000, but
still, that was might as well have been a stadium show that night.
The energy was great. It was a special night. So a lot of good memories coming off, you know, that tough time that we all endured.
Tell us about your journey to AEW. How did you end up leaving WWE and how did you get involved with AEW?
Yeah, I left WWE in 2013. And I from there, I started working with Don Garber at Major League Soccer. He's the commissioner as a consultant, helping them get their New York franchise, which is NYCFC now, and trying to get a stadium built in Queens, New York, which eventually got approved this year. So I'm happy that happened. And I was busy there, and that was a great experience. But I'll say this, after I left WWE, you know, Jeff Jarrett and Bruce Pritchard at the time were reaching out to me because they were at TNA Impact. Yeah. And you know, I owe a lot to Jeff and Bruce for bringing me back in the business. It was
also they got you back in.
Yeah, they did. I mean, I was a little burnt out, and they got me in. And you know I loved working with Bruce, I love working with Double J. I mean, I work with them now. I mean, I have great chemistry with Jeff. I mean, with what we're doing now with the house shows, house rules we're going to do here with AEW, but. We get each other. We have great chemistry. You know, we're great teammates in that regard. And I learned a lot from him when he was my boss too in that regard. So, and then there was a time where I became like the showrunner backstage for all the wrestling shows that weren't.
Don told me you were even a character on the show once.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was Rolando Menendez, the scumbag reporter that Don created.
Yeah, of course.
Don Callis' creation. I had fun with that, but. At that time, I was working. I helped Dreamer do some shows. I helped Court Bauer at MLW. I helped obviously Impact and Scott D'Amore there all at the same time.
Wow!
So I was busy, mm-hmm. and I was making good money in that regard. And then a mutual friend of ours and your rep, your Barry Bloom, informed me about what may be happening
right
here. Obviously, Jim Ross, who is like a father to me. Who I'm very close with and who's helped me so much in my career.
You're like Jim's day-to-day guy. I remember the cruise, you kind of were like his day. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, Jim is. I'll say this about Jim. There's two male figures in my life, very influential. One being Jack Kern, who's my high school baseball coach. I played in college but for Archbishop Molloy High School. Actually, same coach who coached Big Bill here, Bill Morrissey.
Okay. Yeah.
Big name. He was a big figure for me. I grew up in a single mom household in New York City. So, and then Jim Ross in my professional career, he's been everything. I can learn anything from Jim, whether it's talent relations items,
sure.
Whether it's promotion, whether it's just day to day, very helpful. So, I'm very fortunate. I get to work with guys who helped me out in the past, like, Jim Ross, the aforementioned Jeff Jarrett's of the world, and yourself. I mean, I'm not saying because I'm on your show. I mean, we have a relationship in that regard too. So it's it's exciting.
So how did you finally like? What was your first show that you did for AEW?
I was contacted by someone who helped me out tremendously here too. In the onset was Cody, working very closely with Cody, Rhodes. He reached out to me. You know, they wanted someone. It was time to go in terms of booking venues, running the events, selling tickets. So, you know, Cody reached out to me, and I met Cody, Matt and Nick, the Bucks, a couple of weeks prior to our opening press conference that we did by the pool.
In Vegas, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we hit it off. I did a presentation to the Bucks and to Cody, and then Tony became involved. You know, Keith Mitchell was a big help, too, mm-hmm. and Jim and Barry. So it was a perfect storm happening at that time. And Tony believed in me, and then I, you know, my first show was the first show we had, Double or Nothing.
How was that when, because you mentioned you did some stuff for TNA and mm-hmm. other companies, but this is the first kind of major company that, you know, you're hitting up MGM Grand. Was it hard to get those rooms back then? And did you have the confidence that we could sell whatever it was for the first show, 12,000 tickets or whatever it may be?
I was really confident based upon what happened at All In.
In Chicago.
Yes, yeah. in 2018. But I will say this, in terms of getting that room, the MGM Grant, all credit goes to Bernie Cahill, one of our partners.
Yeah, one of our partners, yeah.
An activist, so one of Tony Khan's partner. And he's one person I listen to each and every time, too, here.
So Bernie is basically, like you said, he's a promoter. He is a manager. I think yes. He manages the Grateful Dead. He manages John Mayer.
Lumineers.
So yeah. He's got a lot of pull in the business.
He does. So he got us into the room. And in terms of that show and subsequent touring after that, it was all on me. So they gave me the ball. Here you go. And you know, coming off the great success of Double or Nothing, support internally from from the Keith Mitchells of the world, Cody Rhodes, Tony. Eventually, we established a rapport working together. I was given autonomy to book the venues. Now, I'll say this: working those smaller promotions after WWE, it helped me in terms of examining and fine tuning finances and P&Ls mm-hmm. in that regard. I think I had a skill set and I was talented when I was at WWE. However, the time away and working with those smaller groups really helped me hone in terms of P&L's, net profits.
What's P&L?
Profit and loss.
Gotcha.
Spreadsheets, data. I really learned a lot, I would say, during that 6-7 year period, and really prepared me well to step into this role at AEW.
So WWE, for example, mm-hmm. and I don't know how they do it now. I'm sure it's kind of still the same. But, you know, we would start on a Friday in, I don't know, Detroit, and then you'd have, you know, Saturday in St. Louis, and Sunday to be Cape Girardeau, and Monday Raw is in Chicago,
yeah.
or whatever. So you would be able to base, you know, you could book your shows, book your trucks, and, you mm-hmm. know, the whole thing. For us, we are just essentially working once a week. I know sometimes it's different. So how do you decide where to go? Do you try and kind of keep it in, you know, chronological, geographical order, or is it more like, how do you kind of figure out what to do?
Well, at the start, we wanted to be production friendly to our production team, who was growing also.
Right.
And getting their, their wings, for lack of a better term. So we would book somewhere close in a geographical area from the week prior, as they got going and got rolling in terms of if we were in KC and then the next week would be in St. Louis. But you always backbook, Chris. That was the case in WWE too. You would set your tent poles, whether it's a pay-per-view or a big show, and then book backwards to route. So at first we did that, but now Tony Khan has great analytical resources. We are going to lean on some of those in terms of data.
It's very much analytical.
Yeah, yeah. We've been around for 4 years now. We can examine our fans, our trends, also set up variables and metrics. So we're going to lean on some of his assets and companies in that regard. Not completely, but some software in terms of helping us out, and also taking calculated risk. That's always part of the equation too.
I mean, it took us a long time to get to the West Coast.
Yes.
I mean, we just started going there. Basically this year. I know we had the one show at the Forum last summer, but the rest of it, like Seattle's and Portland's and all that stuff is this year now, right?
Yeah, it happened a lot. I mean, we had a lot of shows in frequency this year, but I will say this. In the beginning, we didn't know how strong our product was going to get out of the gate.
Sure.
So, booking shows in the West Coast at 4 o'clock midweek was always going to be a risk. until we knew, you know, we had a solidified brand.
Now, a risk there for us because we're new, because WWE runs shows on the West Coast all the time.
Yeah, but you know, we're new. Gotcha. It's 4 o'clock on a Wednesday where we have to have a show go on air at 5. Can we sustain that? Let's see how we're doing in these other markets, what our average attendance is. And then the pandemic hit. You know, after the pandemic was over and we were going to hit the road again, we started in 2021. If you notice, when we started, a lot of those markets, just like WWE, were in Florida, Texas.
Yeah.
States with less restrictions, purposely done. North Carolina's of the world. And then we eventually made our way to the West Coast. There's some great markets that we have to hit, strongholds, like obviously New York, but Chicago. You always hear fans when we book Chicago and Jess, oh, again, this and that. I'll say this. There's not one city in America that can have $2 million gates in the same summer in two different venues like we did last year in Chicago. There's a reason why we go to Chicago a lot, because we have great venue partners there. We have great negotiations. And that's part of the equation, too. We have to negotiate great deals. We have to have a certain percentage of our net back from those ticket sales. Because if you're selling tickets and you only make a fraction of it.
Sure, if you do $1 million gate, but the room costs $900,000 to rent for the night, yeah, you're really not doing so well.
Yeah, it's a reason why WWE didn't have many TVs at MSG for a decade. That was one of them.
Sure. I always kind of got the thought that we just did MSG because you had to, because it's the place to be. I don't think we ever really made much money in New York City at MSG as a company.
Non-TV shows we did. I remember you and Cena were on top of one in 2009.
It was the highest gate at the time.
We made a lot of money that night.
Yeah.
We did. That's part of the equation. But I think WWE laid off the Garden for that reason. And also the advent of Barclays Center came into town. Mm-hmm. So they did TVs there, which, mm-hmm. It wasn't as expensive as the Garden, but now I think their relationship is a lot better.
Well, that's what Vince,
MSG and WWE.
When Vince, I had a conversation with him when ROH was going in there, and there was a talk that I was going to do something on it with New Japan, and we discussed it, and he's like, he didn't want me to be involved, and he was saying, my father used to say, the Garden is the Garden, Vince. Mm-hmm. And that's it. The Garden is the Garden. That's all you need to know, right?
Yeah.
But for us, though, so when you're talking about going to some of these new cities, and I'm sure for a while people are probably saying, hey, why are we always going to Washington, D.C., or why are we going here? Like, it was good to go to the Seattles and go out there, but you just mentioned because we had to make sure that we could draw there first.
Correct. And getting back to the point about production, so, it's costly to move 11 to 12 trucks, 13 trucks. I know WWE has more. And for us, especially when we're back on the road last year and gas prices were extremely high.
People don't understand that. It's the same touring with Fozzy. It kills you.
That all played into factors. So, we took calculated risk to be in the Northeast a lot last fall. And we didn't fare as well as we did the initial times. And we didn't know that because we didn't know that would be the result is what I'm trying to say. Is that the first few times, we did very, very well. I mean, we sold out many shows. So, it's you live and learn, but also in this business, it's cyclical. It's how the brand is perceived and how you're doing in terms of TV ratings, whatever it may be. It's a cyclical business. You really can't say we're going to do this time because we did that.
Right.
So, but you acknowledge it, you realize it, and you get a pulse of the crowd. And you also, that's where data comes into. And, in terms of knowing where your fan base and heat maps that indicate where they're coming from. If they're coming, traveling long distances to come to a show for a TV show, how far they're out, that incorporates digital buys and our spend and our reach in that regard.
Is it hard?
That all plays into factors. They're all variables.
Is it hard to try and predict? Like, for example, when we just did San Francisco for the last pay-per-view at the Chase Center, and then we do two shows at the Cow Palace on Wednesday, Friday. So now we have a Wednesday, Friday, Sunday show all within the same market. Is it hard to predict, like, I know we did it in Vegas last year too. It seems like it'd be hard. Like, what cities can sustain three big shows within 5 days?
Yeah, they're few.
Yeah,
and we're learning that. I mean, New York maybe. I think you have to spread out the venues here and there. Maybe do a Prudential or, well, or so, UBS.
And there's so many places close to New York. Like you said, you could do a Philly, correct, New York, you know, if you needed to or whatever.
Chicago. And, you know, we have a great partner in Hoffman Estates that gives us a great deal. There was a reason why we did three shows last year there. We came back with a lot of revenue after, mm-hmm, and after stagehands and stagehands and labor costs at venues, that is the lion's share of your costs, mm-hmm, on event day. So, you know, that's that plays into factor, and also you know, the rent deals you can get from venues in terms of who can sustain the 3 days. But I would say because the novelty of it, possibly LA still. Mm-hmm. But I say Chicago, LA, and special events.
I know we had three, but then we just dropped a show. Is that because Rampage was originally going to happen and then it didn't happen? Is that because the TBS moved it around or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, because we're going to be on air on Saturday.
Gotcha.
With Rampage, and
so it doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and we need to be at T-Mobile Arena preparing on Saturday for that pay-per-view.
Right.
You know, that's a stake at the plate.
Sure.
The pay-per-view.
When you put a building on sale, because we've talked about this before, obviously you mentioned 60% right out of the gate. Hopefully it's a lot. But then do you concentrate on opening certain sections to kind of fill out the room as much as you can? Because, if you have, I don't know, let's say a 5,000-seat arena and you got 4,000 tickets sold, you don't want them to be haphazardly around. You want them to kind of be all in the same area, right?
That's something I have to monitor each and every day.
Yeah.
And adjusting pricing. It's something that a new hire here, old friend at WWE, old colleague Mike Mansour and I are going to really hone in on terms of monitoring those sales. But that's something you have to take a look at. And if it means a price adjustment or on the other hand, if you're selling briskly, flexing pricing so you can take home some more money at the end of the day. But in terms of the sequence of sales, you have to be on top of it. You just can't put it on sale and leave it and come back to it a week later or two, because then you don't want to relocate folks the day of the show. I've been there, done that, but I pride myself in not putting that onus on the venues, because it's a pain in the ass for the venues to, and for the fans, most importantly the fans. It's a customer relation issue. Even though you're going to upgrade them to a certain location and camera view, they don't understand that when you're trying to explain that to them on site.
Sure.
And it's something we try to avoid, but as we grow our structure and our process here, we're lean and mean to start, but I'll be working with Mike on that on a lot of things, and we're lean and mean, but we're improving, and we get a lot of personnel. We have a great asset coming here too from WWE. He was there forever, Adam Hopkins. I look forward to working with Adam in terms of getting the local word out in these markets.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you.
Adam's a PR guy, folks. Jason.
Who's that?
No, Adam's a public relations.
Yeah, of course.
Guy.
Yeah. No, Adam and Adam.
Wherever anyone's listening, yes.
Yeah, and Adam also was with WWE for 25 years as well. So to have guys with experience in this business, it just continues, because it's a very unique business, as you know. How many shows do you have spinning at the same time? Because I'm sure you have to keep an eye on all of them.
I would say anywhere between 15 to 20.
Wow.
And for folks at WWE, it's even more so, because they go on sale of late, like a concert series, where they of late have been putting out shows seasonal. They'll put out 30, 40 shows at once for the same on sale date. There's pros and cons to it. And doing so, they're able to do it because they have a frequent amount of shows. But I would say about 15 to 20 shows at a time, where you have to monitor, you have to make sure we're on the right stations promoting, updating spots. That's part of the process too.
Sure.
Poor Kevin Sullivan here with us. Because we change and wrestling changes. And if you're going match specific, you have to change spots. We have a new look like we did in January. That's all part of the process, and that takes time. Right now here, it's just me in our department.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to need some assistance with that, I'm assuming, at some point, right?
Sooner or later. Your match specific, it just reminds me, as someone who I admired, sitting down with Michael Hayes for all the house shows and shows in terms of, we would sit down every Friday going over what's going on and what matches to promote and making sure the updates, the updated spots were there, and you know, that's part of the process. I remember Michael saying, you know, it's on you, Raphael. If it's the department, but if these spots aren't up there, I'm coming to you. Yeah. In that regard. But I learned so much from Michael in terms of promotion too, in terms of thinking like a talent, and Laurinaitis too in that regard, because a part of my job is a lot of talent relations issues too in that regard. So Michael was a big resource in helping me map out how we promote events.
What's interesting too, because you know, I think probably in the early part of both of our careers, the matches were kind of the selling point. Okay, you know, you got Jericho versus Austin coming to El Paso. I remember we did a show there, or Winnipeg, and people would buy tickets on the match. Mm-hmm. Now it seems like it's changed a lot, where people buy tickets. Oh, AEW's coming. Let's go to the show. And you might not know any matches. Like, I know now we're promoting for UBS in 2 weeks, some of the big matches. But, like, you know, if you're going to go to Milwaukee, which is in 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Two weeks.
Well, there's no matches announced. So that kind of probably changes the way you promote as well. And it's not just AEW, it's WWE as well, or whoever it may be.
Yeah, it's tough for everyone because, you know, we're judged by ratings each and every week. And and we're episodic TV where, you know, General Hospital's not giving out their finish.
Right.
You know, right, 2 weeks before the air. So it's the same situation in that regard. So it's tough, but we have, you know, there's ways to let folks know, you know, a title's going to be in play, or a special appearance or return by someone. Yeah, you know, there's different hooks to utilize.
We used to do the dark match, remember? Like, you would go on sale and say, and you're going to see Jericho versus Edge. Yeah. And then you'd go through the whole show, and if you had, you'd go there for 2 minutes and do some shitty match just so people knew.
Six-man tag.
But yeah, but they knew they were getting something, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, and they were important matches. And those, you know, we used to call them the TV main events. With Michael, you know, he would come in, okay, you know, because, you know, Michael will have an idea, being on the creative team, where the story was going to be that going that particular week or time, and what talent to lay off, maybe being on those main events, but who we can utilize. Poor John Cena had to work all of them, no matter what story he was
always
in.
Always, yeah, because they wanted to
know. He was a workhorse. That
but
guy,
you had to know, the people needed to know that Cena was going to be there. Yeah. So Cena would be, like, Cena versus, we did, John and I did probably 36 dark matches. Cena versus Jericho. Okay, for sure, we'll buy the ticket for that. Even if the Raw episode had nothing to do with Cena and Jericho, at the end of the night, you'd see that match.
That match would start probably at 11:10.
Yeah.
Or whatever it may be. It'd be short and sweet, but the fans would see what was advertised.
Yeah, so. And then they'd do a little chat at the end, a little talk for the fans, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, John was on all of them for a long time. You know.
Now, I came to you, I come to you all the time, text you constantly.
Yeah.
Are there other talents that do that as well?
In my career, there's been four of them that did that for every show, whether they're on the show or not. Mm. One was the aforementioned Steve Austin, Stone Cold. Mm. CM Punk is one. Mm-hmm. John Cena is another, and you.
That's it.
Four. Who? I mean, every show. I mean, you know, you get it from folks if there's their hometown,
sure, or
they did media. And it's important to tell them, the talent, that too. You know, thank you. You got to thank them. Number one. Number two, tell them what kind of difference they made in terms of putting their time in
for local media.
No doubt, you have to do that.
Oh, sure, you do.
Anyone who, in any business, if you're working with a ball player, you're working you know, with a musician, you got to let these men and females know that you know, their contributions made a difference. It's so important in this entertainment industry to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's the four of you that I remember each and every show, no matter what.
Do you still ever have, or is there such thing as, like, you know, I remember when the Ring of Honor did Madison Square Garden, Vince was not happy. Do we ever get that from WWE of kind of undercutting us or overcutting us? Or
you know, there's markets where, you know, they're there either after or a week or two before us. But I think a lot of that is pure coincidence. Mm. There may have been one or two times I think they may have conveniently booked a show before us. So.
Oh, it's obvious. They did it to us in El Paso a couple weeks ago, I think it was, or Laredo or something like that, didn't they?
They were there a month before us, yeah.
Yeah, but the show,
In Laredo. But then you have stern conversations with venues saying, in that case, the venue didn't let me know until they announced it. So, you know, you have some, you know, you have some strong conversations with venues saying you...
Well, there's some venues that go, hey, we're WWE.
Most venues do. They're really good about it. In that regard.
So they'll let us come in.
Yeah. And I tell every venue, make the most amount of money you can from both of us.
Sure.
Just find some time for us.
Makes perfect sense.
And most venues love hearing that. in that regard. Now, you know, some markets it's tough to, because they're a market that WWE plays two or three times. I'll give you an example. You know, Detroit. You know, we weren't in Detroit for a while because that town went from a four arena town, Joe Louis Arena, Cobo, Little Caesars when it first opened up, and the Palace mm-hmm. to one Little Caesars. So you have the Pistons and Red Wings playing there. Wow. WWE plays that market at least three times a year, mm-hmm. that room. So it took us some time to find a little slice to get in there. And you know, I won't name who, but someone who has a lot of pull there, I worked with doing the bid for the New York team at MLS, and he gave us a chance, and we did great. I mean, we had Blood and Guts there.
We gave a big show, too. Because remember when we were talking about Blood and Guts, it was like, what arenas do we have coming up that can fit this?
I was at LaGuardia Airport. You texted me feverishly. He does, folks.
I did because I wanted, because what's on this night? I remember Tony thinking, it might be this, might be that. I was like, Raph, you got to let me know. Is it Detroit? And we were able to figure that out.
We were. And and we were able to do that. And the initial Blood and Guts was going to be at Prudential Center, if we recall. And that was another conversation that you and I had in that regard for the initial one, which never came to fruition.
And when we're saying big enough, not big enough from a city standpoint, big enough for the venue to be able to house the apparatus of the Blood and Guts.
You have to have a load-in date.
Yeah.
You have to, when you're bringing in two cages, you have to set up two rings. You have to do rehearsals. You have to, from a production standpoint, be ready to go on event day. Our production team has grown, and we do many same-day load-ins and shows now.
And
WWE does that, has been doing that forever, and they had to do that when they were doing Raw and SmackDown back-to-back dates. But, you know, they're a bigger company, and they have more resources and more people working compared to us. So the load-in date was key for our production team in the beginning here, and now they, you know, when I tell them we need the only way we can get into a market or a venue, and Tony loves being at these sports venues, and I don't blame him. Great resources backstage, mm-hmm. great from a production standpoint. You said from Blood and Guts, where we can rig it, wait, and also the same day load in and show helps us out too from a labor standpoint. We're paying unions one day and opposed to two.
Right. So, last few things for you, Raph. What is the kind of, like, we just did Winnipeg, we've done Toronto. Mm-hmm. What's the international status for AW?
There are plans for the UK.
Because obviously we're big in the UK as well.
Yeah. You know, we have a great TV partner in ITV there. You know, we do have plans. I mean, it's no secret.
Yeah. Tony announced it.
So, you know, we are discussing plans for the UK, concrete plans. So,
which is great.
So that's one. And, you know, we're in, many nations in countries in terms of TV, but it's important. And I think I did 80 international tours with WWE as a tour manager. You have to have good TV in the country and let the fans have a habitual viewing tendency for the show before you bring your product over. You can't bring in a product until that TV is strong.
Sure.
So we're still there right now in terms of cultivating our viewership in many of these countries, but internationally, this summer we'll be in Canada. Love to be in Quebec and Ottawa soon too.
Montreal, obviously, yeah. But Toronto, that Toronto show was just huge. Because the first time we were in Toronto, we had to do the smaller room twice because I think was it Michael Bublé that was in there? Or
no, it was.
Leafs?
No, same company. Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment runs the Coca-Cola Coliseum where we were and Scotiabank Arena. Mm. We needed to have a commitment to TSN, our great partner in Canada,
sure.
who was really, really pressuring us to come to Canada to have a show. And in terms of avails, I think WWE had a show at Scotia in August. And yeah, there's some exclusivity windows.
I got you. Sure, there is. It's like that for rock and roll too. Yeah.
And we have to adhere to them.
Yeah.
And so do venues. So we wanted to accommodate our rights holder in TSN to be there before the year ended. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, the only venue in Toronto that they could give us was Coca-Cola Coliseum. So instead of just going one for a short, for a one night show. We usually do every Wednesday. We did two nights, Wednesday, Thursday. Place holds 8,000. We sold out both, which is great. But they told us we'll do this, but you know, we'll give you the opportunity to play the big room when it fits between
time is right. Yeah.
When they also want I think they want to see what our product can do there, and we knew you knew.
Yeah.
You know, you and I were joking, and we probably just sold 30,000 the first show that we had there. Yeah. But it's good to have venue management companies believe in you, and they all do. I get calls. Jeff and I get calls now after House Rules now.
That's great.
From DNC Markets. It's great. And, there's belief in the product. And a lot has to do with the fact that our ownership, Tony Khan, he's a big player. You know, he's a sports owner.
Sure.
You know,
big teams. Yeah.
You know, we talk to every venue, and whether it's venues we play in and don't play. And the reason we get in the room sometimes is because they're speaking to a sports owner.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And we're speaking on behalf of a sports owner.
It legitimizes it.
It does. You know, a lot of them are sports clients, so that helps out. Also help. Bernie plays a big factor too. His shadow. Mm-hmm. He can bring a lot of dates to a lot of venues.
Last question for you, man. For the 25 years you've been doing this, who are the biggest ticket sellers from the business that you've seen?
I would say. See, I joined the business right when you joined WWE and Rock and Stone Cold and DX. It was incredible. You know, you see notes on internet now or social media. Oh, yeah, this show did 8,000. What a great result. And it is. It's a great result now. But I remember, we were doing 15.
For house shows.
For house shows, yeah.
For house shows,
so,
yeah.
But that was an unprecedented time. Yeah. So, I Steve obviously rocked, the introduction of yourself, DX, all around the same time. It was a perfect and Mick. You can't forget Mick. Mick was so important when Steve went out. A great baby face. After that, John Cena.
To this day. Cena on a show, he sells 5,000 tickets.
He's great. And I'll tell you what about John. When it was a media day, it was 4 in the morning, 4:30. He was there in the hotel, ready to go. All business. Cena, Rey Mysterio. Congratulations to Ray. On his Hall of Fame. That man sold tickets.
Really? That's cool.
He did. I would say, right before he won his title soon thereafter, a lot of it was market specific too, but he moved the needle. I'll say this about Big Dave. He moved tickets when he first became champion.
Batista.
Yeah. He did in that regard. And then here... at the onset, I mean, the whole rollout of AEW, the curiosity of it. I think the big players were Cody, yourself, Kenny, and the Bucks. You guys weren't out there each and every week.
Right.
They wanted to see you.
Yeah.
Which was huge in that regard, in terms of true needle movers, mm-hmm. as they say.
Well, dude, it's been great talking to you, man. It's very interesting stuff. I've been wanting to do this for a while.
Yeah,
it's a show day, too, so we got to get to work here. But it was awesome stuff, and I think you do a great job.
Thank you, Chris, for the opportunity. And every time, whatever the topic is, I appreciate it.
I'll be texting you in about 20 minutes to find out where we're at today.
That's okay. I'll tell you how walk-up's going. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, dude.
All right.